I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses of Seizures. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, Michael Mecco back from France. Welcome back to listening to the show, and I'm glad I'm back. It was great. We had a great trip. It was kind of an abbreviated trip. We were there to shoot a show in Champaign, which we did, but we had to do it on tight notice because the kind of weather. I don't know if you guys are, if you're like following the wine world weather stuff, but the weather in France has been really, really bad this year, kind of like what's been happening in Texas. There was more rain this spring in Burgundy than ever in the history of Burgundy. That was followed hail in Burgundy. The weekend we were there, which was 2 weekends ago, the weekend we arrived, there had been hail in Chablis, hail in Beaujolais, and this is the point where you've got the fruit beginning to set, so it's really bad for the vineyards. And then it just rained. Like, we were there 4 days, and we had 4 hours of clouds when it wasn't raining. It was crazy, and then there was a possible airline strike, so we kind of had to get out of Dodge before we would get stuck. I mean, getting stuck in Paris isn't the worst thing for 6 or 7 days, except we had to film this week in New York, so you kind of like, you know, you cameramen are on the payroll and you can't miss shoots and deadlines. So we're supposed to fly in on Saturday and leave on Saturday, and we flew in on Saturday and flew out on Thursday morning. But it was great, man. Champagne, I'll tell you what, we'll talk about what I learned there another show when I have more time to bore down. But if you've ever listened to me on the radio or watched me on TV, I'll tell you what, Champagne is, if you think about the grapes involved, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, how they pair with food really well, and the bubble thing just adds to it. I don't know why we don't drink more Champagne with meals rather than just before meals as a toast. It's kind of like an afterthought, you know, pop the cork, pour it into a flute, drink it, then move on to something else. And I'm like, really? I could just stick with Champagne through the meal, after the meal. It's great stuff. But we'll do that later. Got a fun show today. Oh, it's also Negroni week. It's funny. I have to say something. Negroni week. This is Negroni week now. So I'm 59 years old, 60 my next birthday, and I've been drinking Negroni since I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s. Don't know why. Italian heritage, grew up drinking Campari, like bitter things. Italians like bitter herb. We'd eat dandelions and escarole and all that stuff. So I've always had an affinity for bitter greens and bitter flavors. And I remember like when Negroni was like an outlier cocktail. You'd go into restaurants in the 90s and order Negronis and nobody knew what the hell they were. They said, we can't make them. Why not? We don't have chartreuse. You don't need chartreuse. You know, here, do you have Campari? Do you have sweet vermouth? Do you have gin? You got a Negroni, equal parts on ice with an orange. But anyway, Negroni week's huge. So I feel like my bastard child's done well. 2011, I did the cover story for Edible Manhattan, and it was a cocktail issue, and it was about Negronis. So yes, I'm a proud father of that drink and a daily imbiber of it. Speaking of drinks, we're going to segue. My first guest, we got a great show today, 2 guests. First guest is Warren Bubro, Jersey resident. Great story. This guy's been everything. Went to these great, you know, Morristown Beard School, Emerson College, was an engineer. I mean, this guy's had like 7 careers in his life, including a stint at some point when I always wonder what possesses people and they have like a great paying job to decide they want to work in restaurants, because it's like, really? Really? Just cook at home, watch TV. You don't really want to do this, but he did it. And now he's segued like to career number whatever. I'm holding the July 2016 issue of High Times Magazine. That's right. What are you shaking your head for? Come on. You've heard of High Times. Come on. It's the headlines on the cover, or the, here's the cover stories. Ganja Gourmet, weed-infused recipes and dining. Must-see Island of Perps, I don't know what that is, growing legal in Arizona. Okay, whatever. And In the Kitchen with Action Bronson. Yeah, our boy from Vice, the bearded stoner from Vice, who hit him and Eddie Wang are just killing it with their food stuff. Action show is, this is effing delicious, I think is what it's called. He's hysterical. But Warren's here because a book landed on my desk a month or two ago called, drumroll, Cannabis Cocktails, Mocktails, and Tonics. The Art of Spirited Drinks and Buzzworthy Libations, collection of 75 recipes. And this is your like fourth book on cocktails?
That's my fourth book, yeah. Yeah, fourth book since 2013.
That's prolific. So talk about this one. I mean, I'm just going to back this up. So I'm in this sort of the food space in New York, and I know a lot of guys spread across generations. You know, guys that are older than me, guys that are my age, a lot of guys that are younger than me. Let's face it, most of the world's younger than me at this point. And the food scene, it's great because there's a lot of these kids in their 20s and 30s that are really moving the ball forward. So much talent in New York kitchens, so much talent in New York in the food space, beyond kitchens and butchers and bakers and that sort of thing. And kind of around the edges, you know, I've heard little rumors of guys saying, hey, I don't know if you're interested, but, you know, I'm in the ice cream business, the sort of artisan ice cream business, and I, for my friends, I have this small batch of, like, edible ice creams, you know, if you want to try that. I get the sugar from so-and-so, and I know another guy's in the chocolate business. He said, I don't know if you're interested, but, you know, I've got these edibles. And there's, you know, hearing murmurs, and again, across generations, because there's this sort of pent-up idea that's a real one that, I mean, if you look at California, Oregon, Colorado, decriminalization, that's going to happen on the West Coast before it comes east. But at some point, probably a state like Vermont and then maybe Massachusetts, these sort of bastions of liberal thinking are going to start to swing that pendulum on this side. And, you know, I don't think New York will be one of the first or second or even third or fourth, but at some point, it's already been decriminalized. I mean, heck, I live on the Lower East Side, and if you walk down the street on any given day, it's weed scented, man. It's like there ain't no secrets, and the police are just whatevs. They just kind of let it go unless you're in, you know, in their face with it. So at some point, everyone knows there's going to be billions to be made in that space in this state, and across the country, multiples of billions. I mean, it already was with Colorado in the first year. Talk about what led you to this book, because I mean, you've done a bunch of books. You're a known cocktail guy. You're a brand ambassador for a great artisan rum. You had all these careers from engineering to chefing to cocktails. Why this book now?
It was the right book at the right time, really, and it came to me in a dream, if you will. I opened myself up to dreams, and I dream in color, and everything that I've accomplished and failed at in my life was foreseen in a dream.
Carl Jung, Freud might have something to say with that.
Well,
there's something that goes, something that goes on in your brain while you're sleeping that's great. And I've been, even since I was a little kid, I used to take when I was a kid, I used to keep logs of my dreams. And I think once you sort of have that memory set, you kind of remember them. My wife claims she doesn't dream. I'm like, you dream, you just don't remember them.
Everybody dreams.
Yeah.
It's whether you choose to remember what you
right.
dream, and it doesn't happen right away. And really what manifested itself and the framework of how it became was so profound to me. I was at BookCon in New York City. The chairman or the head of our publishing company was in front of me, and he was saying something about, Warren, your books are doing very well for us. And I looked at him, and I didn't know what to say, because anyone saying something nice to me is pretty fabulous when you failed at so many things in life. And so I looked at him, and I smiled, and I looked over on the shelf, and there was a book on marijuana cultivation on the shelf. And then I remembered that dream that I had, and I said, Ken, I want to write a book on marijuana cocktails, on cannabis cocktails. And he looked at me and he said, if you can get me a proposal in 3 days, because we're a publishing board, you know, pub board is right now. And, you know, if you can get that into me, we'll take a good look at it. What's in front of you is the book.
Drank a lot of coffee, didn't sleep for the next...
I don't really... Well, you know, I drink coffee in the morning, but really what it was is I write so much magazine work, and I'm really familiar with how to do a really tight, crisp proposal.
Right.
I put my pen to paper, and the words flowed.
Beautiful. So we talked about this. I mean, one of the... As I sort of would bore down with these associates of mine who were kind of playing around in that space. And I think the New York Times has written about it. It was a story last week or the week before about kids smoking something called wax, which is one of the derivatives in those little vape smoking things on the street. So, you know, wealthy suburban kids coming in the city with one of those, and so lighten up, you can't really smell anything, there's no smoke, and the dosages are just like...
They're way off the charts.
Off the charts. Yeah. So whatever. I mean, I don't know how that works, but... But to get to that wax stage, to pull the THC, the active ingredient, out of pot, there's a couple of things, and I know that the butane was one of them. There's this sort of stuff.
I don't mess around with that stuff. First off, I don't play with that stuff.
So that's kind of nasty. That, right off the bat, I'm thinking, this sounds like a meth lab.
What it really is when you live in a place that's not your own, they will always remember you. So I don't ever want to be remembered for that, because it's very dangerous. It's volatile. I've never even played around with it. I have no desire to. I don't have the equipment. Why would I want to? There's so much more fun stuff out there that's natural rather than playing around with true carcinogenics. I mean, I don't know how they get it there, but that's not my thing.
Me neither. And it just again, it sounds like meth lab stuff. So
yeah,
what are the extractions you're using? How does it work?
I decarb the cannabis, heat it in the oven, or use, you know, cook it up in the microwave. There's a couple different ways of doing it. Sometimes you do a sous vide. There's all different ways of doing it.
I mean, applying heat for a length of time.
Heat for a length of time to unlock THCA from THC, the stuff that gets you feeling happy and feeling, you know, feeling nice inside, is the result of that. Again, I'm not a scientist, not a doctor. I'm fascinated by the early apothecary. Love the idea of tinctures and tonics. They were used in the apothecary. I was down in New Orleans last year for the Tales of the Cocktail. Go down every year.
Yeah,
I did
great.
A presentation at the Pharmacy Museum, and they were doing a presentation of their own on cannabis in the early apothecary.
Seriously.
And that's probably where I got the idea from right there. But
part of the
I already
American
knew what
canon.
I was going to do. I already knew what I was going to do. But it just made so much more sense when you saw Indian cigarettes and knew that they had cannabis in them.
So you have this on one of the pages, page 30, an oven method. This is kind of the one you see if you go to the internet and look this stuff up.
Yeah, that's right. That's basically the one that everyone looks at.
250 degrees.
Yeah, 250 or 240.
For an hour and change.
Right.
Grind it into powder.
Yep.
And proceed any way you want. At that point, you can bake with it. You can do anything.
I even infuse it into Vichy water. Like,
so
you
how
said
do you,
you were in France.
How,
I mean, there you go.
How does the infusion work with spirits?
It works beautifully. It
Same
works
thing.
All, it works all too well. And it makes and they play very nicely in the sandbox together. And I also give the recipe in case you go a little bit overboard. It happened to me down in Disney World last year. Professionally speaking, I overdosed myself on my own product, which is something you never want to do, especially not in Disney World. So I was able to get to a lemonade stand, and if you take a couple peppercorns and drink down a glass of fresh lemonade, it goes away immediately.
No way.
Yes, absolutely.
No,
and the guy who taught me that is Jerry Whiting of LeBlanc CS, you know, out in Seattle. He's the guy who wrote my foreword, and he really knows what he's talking about, and he gave me that recipe.
So the Narcone, or whatever that's... So
the Narcan.
Narcan
for cannabis
for
overdose.
Cannabis is lemonade
lemon,
with...
Yeah, no sugar. I mean, it's just the lemon juice, fresh lemon juice.
With peppercorns.
You chew the peppercorns, you drink down the fresh lemon
and
juice.
And bang, buzz dead.
Just like that.
That's crazy.
Just like that.
Whoever figured that out?
He did. Jerry. Jerry's the man. LeBlanc CNE Seattle. Ask him.
I remember that. So a couple of years ago, the New York Times had a story. Maureen Dowd, who's one of the editorial writers.
Right, she overdosed herself.
She went to Colorado when the stuff went edible. She wanted to do some investigative reporting.
It was irresponsible. It really was.
What, did she just eat the entire chocolate bar or something?
Yeah, she was probably famished and ate like a 200-milligram chocolate bar.
Which is like 10 times the amount that you
need.
Right,
you know, a beginner, I recommend one basis point of that. Very, very small amount. She didn't need to eat the whole thing. And that's what I don't understand. Why? What is this big emphasis on candy? Why is everything edibles in candy? I mean, it's gummy bears and it's chocolate bars and it's sweet popcorn and everything's about sweet, sweet, sweet. Mm. If you look at my book, there are very few sweet cocktails in there. I'm not into sweets. When I was over in Russia at the Moscow Bar Show and I made rum cocktails in my master class that I taught there, and the Russians came up to me, they're like, we want to try my cocktail. Great. I let them taste the cocktail. What is this? It's not sweet, because they're fascinated by sweet things. Most of the world is fascinated by sweet things. I don't make sweet cocktails. My cocktails are not sweet. They're savories. So what is this huge emphasis on sweet all the time? I can't seem to figure it out. So when you look to my book, it's not just another book of sweet cocktails. It's a book that really deals with medicinals and savories.
Yeah, I think sweet. I mean, we were filming yesterday at a place, and they were talking about making cocktails, and they're not exactly a cocktail-centered bar yet. But we were tasting things, and everyone was saying how we can't stand that, how we can't stand adding syrups. We'd much rather add bitters, and like the whole world of wine, people have moved towards acid wines, towards high acid wines. We've really sort of gone away from oak and sweet and residual sugar. Yeah, exactly.
Plonk.
All the above.
Pretty label syndrome.
So you even go as far, and this was crazy. I'm reading this, and I know so little about marijuana that I'm like, you actually go recommend like certain strains for certain cocktails.
And for different things that you might need alleviation of. And notice I use the word alleviation. It's not cure. No one's curing anything, not a doctor. You need to go to your caregiver for that. You know, they're the ones who, you know, if you're able to have a medical marijuana card, a medical cannabis card, you're probably pretty well advised as to what goes when and where. So all I can give are reasonable explanations of what I think is a good idea, but I might be wrong too. I don't think so, but you know, that's for the listener or for the reader to find out.
So without, again, I come to this with not a whole lot of firsthand knowledge, but I'm just, how would I get a hold of Blue Dream or Maui Wowie? Well, like in the world of weed, you can ask for this stuff today.
You know what I would say? They're no a teenager or a bartender.
Hang around with the right people.
Hang around with the right. No, I can't. Did I say that? I don't think so. Is this national radio?
So Pineapple Kush, BC. I mean, I've never heard of any of this stuff.
Well, it's all stuff that's out there.
Okay,
it's available. I looked on Leafly, and they, you know, they told me where I could get it and for how much?
Leafly. Okay, yes. I'm writing that down. I don't know, man. I drink Negronis and wine.
I love Negronis. I've done an infused Negroni with old Tom gin. That was treated. Very nicely.
That old Tom gin. Got you. Your version
from
of
Vermont.
So talk to me. What got you into? So let's back you up a couple of careers. So I'm just curious. You have this like peripatetic trail.
I failed, man. I failed. That's what brought me here.
Morristown. You went to a great school. You went to a great college, Emerson.
Yeah.
Graduated with a degree in
film.
Film.
I worked in motion pictures and television.
Okay.
New York City and out in the left coast place.
Gotcha. And then just wasn't satisfied.
No, it wasn't that. It wasn't that at all. Full disclosure, my family was in the industry.
Okay.
I couldn't get a job. Nepotism rules in the 80s. That was everything. There was no place who would hire me. And when I did finally get a job, I worked for PIX, WPIX Channel 11.
Yeah.
My shift was 11 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Oh, brutal.
So from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. was my lunch break. I went to work at Danceteria. And that
back
was no life for a 21-year-old.
Yeah, back in the day.
That was no life. I got burned out very quickly, and I moved up to Maine to cool out, to chill out. I got a job as a pot scrubber dishwasher just to clear my head.
Just in a kitchen, sit in the pot sink, keep your eyes to the ground. Mm-hmm. That's what you do.
Yep.
And then that led to kitchen work?
Led to a job as a dishwasher. And then it led to a job as a garmanger. Then it led to a job as a as a dessert cook, and then a grill cook, then a saute cook, and then I went to culinary school. Then
you
I did the
at that
ACF
point.
Apprenticeship. And
okay.
Then I moved to Charleston, and you know, and all hell broke loose with Hugo.
Right, you had a pasta business. You started
fresh
down there.
Fresh pasta, yeah.
Was doing really well.
We did really, really beautifully. We sold to 24 restaurants on a daily basis, three major supermarkets, a retail store on King Street, and then 1989, Hugo came in and spoiled the party. Not just for me, but for a great number of people.
Yes. Well, I mean, we had it happen here with Sandy and Red Hook and all the guys that were doing
I didn't have a year in the bank because that's what it would have taken to reestablish. So I moved out to Scottsdale, did a winter season at the Scottsdale Princess Hotel. They lay you off after the winter. What was I going to do in Scottsdale in the summertime? Watch the pavement melt. Went back to Pennsylvania, worked as a chef, as an executive chef, didn't last long. Went to New York, worked as a sous chef, didn't last long. Got a job in a bank as a teller, kept my mouth shut for 20 years.
No way. That's crazy. Talk about some of the drinks. What are some of your favorites out of this book? Because it's so diverse. I mean, it's so crazy.
You know,
babies.
They are my babies. And this book especially, I didn't get any help from anyone. Normally, I would, you know, ask people for help. But I love the Mezrel cocktail because it really has a New York flair to it, very much a Harlem flair. And if you don't mind me reading just this,
thing,
I'm a huge fan of Manhattan-style cocktails. They make great aperitifs. This one is named after Milton Mez Mezrel, a jazz musician who lived in Harlem in the 1920s. And as Mez himself would have known, the term for a well-rolled cannabis cigarette was a Mezrel. So I just had to commemorate both man and medicine in this elegant cocktail. It combines cannabis-infused sweet vermouth, handmade cocktail cherries, and quality bourbon into a small but well-formed libation that's deeply healing. When you're infusing your vermouth, consider choosing a sativa-indica hybrid strain called Cherry Pie. It's redolent of sweet and sour cherries, and it complements the toasty, oaky flavors inherent in the liquors. As far as making the crushed ice, it's best to place the ice in a Lewis bag, a heavy canvas bag that's made for the job, before whacking it with a wooden mallet or rolling pin.
Great. So you did, I mean, obviously all the research, all the tasting, it's like one long stoned couple of months, or slightly buzzed couple of months.
Actually, it wasn't even a couple months.
Faster.
A lot faster. A hell of a lot faster. And I'll tell you why. I only had a month to write the book.
3 days for the proposal and a month to write the book.
A month to write the book. It's fast. It's like writing a magazine.
Holy shit.
And I'm good at what I do. I'm probably the best at what I do because I'm able to give my publisher exactly what they need in a publishable way so they don't have to do a lot of things to it to make it like this.
And I know I have the book in front of me. Who's your publisher?
It's Fairwinds Press, Cordo Publishing in Beverly, Massachusetts. They've done all my books. They're fabulous.
How'd you hear about them?
They found me.
No way.
Yeah, they wrote me a letter.
No one else has.
I'm telling you, no one else has come to call.
Well, you said hi. I mean, we asked you earlier before we went live on the mic because you're in the current issue of High Times magazine, which is about everything. Got Action Bronson, and what can I tell you?
I mean, I only have an agent. I've done all this on my own.
So you have a Bloody Mary Jane cocktail.
Yeah,
there.
it's like a Caesar from Canada. Has Clamato, but you can't say Clamato because that's a registered trademark. So I said a clam-flavored tomato Bloody Mary.
So tell me about this recipe. What is it?
Oh, that's just a fabulous recipe. Let me just grab it so I can just refer to it. Basically, it's the 6 ounces of your tomato clam mixture.
Right, the Clamato stuff.
Right. That's the, you know, we can't say the name. And then no more than 10 mLs of your favorite cannabis tincture. And then, of course, the garnishes. I would, of course, do it with vodka, but you can just do it with the tomato juice. It doesn't have to have any alcohol at all. But the alcohol is kind of nice because it gives a nice balance.
Yeah, it cuts it. I mean, that's mm-hmm. I'm not a huge vodka fan. I think
right context.
Yeah, anyone lived through the 90s were like, okay, we're kind of done with that. Clearless, flavorless, odorless.
Sweet, you know, right, clear, flavorless.
But it has
it's supposed to be.
But it has its point. So the tincture there that you're talking about, right. So that's in drop form. How was that made?
The tincture is made by... I do it with Everclear, or I can do it with a high-proof alcohol like vodka. I like doing it with mezcal. It gives a little smokiness, right. A lot of mystery. Whatever liquor you like.
But the same idea that you had before of either
sous
vide. But it's
concentrated. It's really concentrated. It's heated for a long period of time until it becomes like a, I wouldn't say like a roux, but I would say like a demi-glace.
That thick.
Mm-hmm. And then you cut it. Now it might not work in a medicine dropper. You might have to pour it into a teaspoon
because it's too viscous.
These can be very viscous.
Yeah, those droppers
it was very
too.
Oily.
Somebody was doing something about recipes, and they were talking about like when you buy bitters, mm-hmm. how these recipes talk about how many shakes of the bitters.
Yeah, well, Angostura is shakes, and everything else is drops.
So. And it goes
or
those
shows.
And right, and those holes are so variable from bitter to bitter that you should really measure them some other way because it can be like 20-1 depending on who's you're using.
Well, I'm all about not making everything the same.
Okay, all right. But it's funny, for this High Times article, they got a hold of you, too.
Yes. Yeah, they contacted
me. They just found you on Twitter.
Twitter, yeah. Right. And I have 11,100 engaged Twitter followers.
What's your handle on Twitter?
At Warren Bobrow with a number one.
Okay, spell.
At WarrenBobrow, and then the one.
Is there another Warren Bobrow out there that just says at Warren
Bobrow? I had it, and it was a mess. Someone cyber or whatever it is, they grabbed it, and they were... abusing my followers and really going after people under my name. I don't know how it was a hacker. And I contacted Twitter and they were very proactive. They said, just you know, open up another account with a number one and we'll take care of it. And now someone else has Warren Favreau.
That's hysterical. I guess, I mean, it happens to me with my credit cards at least once a year where somewhere, somehow I'll get this Bank of America alert. I'll be like, no, I gotta do this again and, you know, fix all the Easy Pass stuff.
Yeah.
So where can we get this? Amazon? So where's this book available?
Yeah, I'm a real fan of indie bookstores, so I would say try your independent bookstore.
For sure.
I mean, we love Amazon because I can get instant metrics and know how the book is selling. Always could sell better. Right now, it's, you know, I really won't have a read on it, how well it's doing. For a little while, I mean, I can get a basic idea by the Amazon metrics that they let me see, that, you know, any author can see. But so Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores. It's being translated evidently into French and Dutch.
No way.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
that's...
All my books are translated into French, but this one is going to be into Dutch as well, as far as I know from the publisher. And what else can I tell you? I can tell you that it's the first book on the topic. I can tell you that it hasn't been easy. I can tell you that there's going to be a lot of people out there who are not going to like what I'm doing, and there's going to be a lot more who are going to give me stuff over it.
Right.
And they do, and they're already. But I've written enough books to let it fly off my back, hopefully.
So this would be just like sort of the hater criticism because it has to do with marijuana?
No, it's not that. They think that my recipes are too strong. Oh. And I don't believe that they are. For me, they're not too strong. And for someone who's sick, they're probably right on target.
So from within the community of people that do edibles?
I don't know who the community is. It's faceless, nameless. Yeah. But I will...
The way the internet is, the way commenting is.
Right, when someone, you know, shouts behind their computer, they're big and tall and handsome and rich. Right. And, you know, they can move armies. But the way that it is for me is I've received so many positive accolades for it that it really is a gift for me. And I'm the luckiest man in the world. I mean, sitting here in front of you, you're famous. I mean,
but
it's true. And I have my gnome Klaus in front of me too.
Klaus,
and he's the famous one.
Klaus the gnome.
The
South. But we
gnome.
Do. I don't want to throw this out because again, I have no expertise in this. But in talking to people that are considering getting involved in the space in New York City, who have been approached, and again, there's money there. There's anticipation at some point that door is going to go down and it's going to open up a $1 billion industry. Well, one of the questions is how do we quantify dosage? And how are we doing the extraction?
Yeah. I don't think anyone can really quantify the dose, and I'm going to go on record for that. I think what works for me may not necessarily work for you. I have a very high tolerance. What I can take might not be what you can take. We have these basic rules of thumb that less is more and never more than one cannabis cocktail per hour. I would say go towards 2 hours, but I do write in the book 1 hour. You'll know your body. You'll know yourself, you know, after you've done it a couple times. I give you the keys to the kingdom in the book. Make it easy. There's so much disinformation out there. Mm. And I've been accused of not having the right ratios and everything else. And I say, you know what? They all work for me.
And
I can't tell you what it works for anyone else.
Right. Write your own book.
Write your own book.
Right.
Tell me what it is. That's, you know, it's like a horse race. You know, who's going to get to the finish first? But it was not a race at all. I just was following my dreams.
And the absorption, I think that was another sense for people like myself that haven't really, you know, gone into the space. But it's not through your stomach line. Like alcohol goes
through your
stomach.
Kidneys.
Right. So it's got to go into your digestive system. So there's this delay that can be an hour and a half or 45 minutes, depending on what you've had in your gut.
I play around with infusions all the time. And the infusion that I'm working with right now hits in about 10 minutes. And I know it, and I know it works because it's not overpowering because I didn't put that much cannabis in it. But I can tell you that it does work, and it works every time. And I have to go on record, and I always will, that this was not a stoner book, and it would have never been published. Someone else would have had to do that book. That wasn't going to be me. My publisher would absolutely not entertain a book that was written under those premise. We tried to write a book that really took away a lot of those problems with wanting to just use it to get stoned. I mean, any idiot can double or triple or quadruple the amounts of cannabis that you use in the recipe, but I can't stop them from doing that. All I can say is for medicinal purposes, check with your doctor first. Here's a great guide. I think it works. Give it a try.
And, you know, this pendulum's swinging. I mean, I got kids. One of my sons lives at home, and I guess not the best dad in the world, but I was always kind of counterculture or not. So I, back when Vice was a little more edgy and it was sort of behind the counters at skateboard shops, my kids skate, my kids surf, you know, I'd bring Vice home and we'd all read it, the do's and don'ts, and laugh and the snarky humor. And it's really funny. And now Vice has become like a digital media platform. It's huge. You're right. I mean, Rupert Murdoch invested News Corp invested $70 million for a 5% share of Vice. That's to show you where they are. And the Vice TV, I mean, they've got a weed kid or something. Mm-hmm. They got this kind of Indian looking kid that has a show on pot that's on every week when you watch Action Bronson, when you watch Eddie Wong. I mean, it's just, it's weaving
part of the mainstream.
It's part of the mainstream.
You know, and I'm a 55-year-old guy who happens to be very well preserved, so I can work with different types of people. And this is one that I just happen to feel very comfortable with. You know, the liquor business is great, and it's kept me in a house, and it's kept me working. But I will say that my natural proclivity is for cannabis.
Good for you. So the name of the book, Cannabis, Cocktails, Mocktails, and Tonics. Spirited drinks and buzzworthy libations. There's 75 recipes, a whole bunch of different ways for you to do the extraction. From, we talked baking, microwave, sous vide, mm-hmm. an explanation on how to do it. Should you be interested? I mean, it's the only book out there. Warren Barber, thanks so much for coming on.
Mike,
Too Funny
my
Man.
Pleasure.
No,
honored.
Be well. Cheers. Be well. Stay tuned. We have my buddy, the food critic from Eater, coming in. Ryan is so funny. We're going to talk about pretty much what he's been doing lately. Ryan Sutton's his name. You know that. We're going to talk about Gabe Stolman, who's a great restaurateur in the West Village. He's really done really, really well. He's got a great story. He's a super smart guy. He's really, I think he's got 7 or 8 restaurants, Celeste, I heard. We talk about tipping versus non-tipping and how he's kind of flip-flopped on this. The Tuna Sandwich at Bread's Bakery, and then Pasquale Jones, which is this really great new restaurant for the people that had Charlie Bird. It's a great story, and pizza after that. So stay tuned for that right after this break from folks that make this show possible. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vida's living in Rome, Cola Vida's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you, this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, the soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So the Bordeaux whites are amazing, you know, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds tell all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly, but If you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux aisle, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Hey, folks, welcome back. Mike Calimeco here. Yeah, we're back from France. We got a couple. What is it, June? I guess I got two more shows this month, something. Because I go into hiatus for the summer. July and August, I kind of disappear and make myself scarce and stay at the beach. But anyway, Ryan Sutton, pleasure, man. Pleasure.
Pleasure being here.
So if you haven't heard of Ryan, it's crazy. Just go to Eater and read his New York restaurant reviews, his commentary. He really brings a great voice to it. Prior to writing for Eater, he was with Bloomberg for 2.5, 3 years.
Eight and a half years.
Okay, 2.5 times 3. That many years. Eight years. Got a great voice, really gets it. And it's funny, because I've said this to you a couple times. You were the guy that wrote that Per Se review a year before Wells wrote it, which was really a huge takedown. I was talking to somebody in, well, a kitchen today about that place and about that scene. And then your take on David Chang's latest, which you were there like, you know, the usual reviewing time for 6 weeks after he opened. You talked to Dave, you talked about the noise, you talked about the food. And Pete Wells acknowledged, he read your review and said, I'm going to wait a couple of months till they fix the sound. Came back 3 months later, which is kind of fair play, took the gloves, you know, off kind of thing. And then let's do this, and came up with the same conclusion you did.
And that was flattering. And finally, not to go too much off message, but it's interesting to see what has happened to Nishi in the wake of the Ryan Sutton, that's me, review, and the Pete Wells review. It has backtracked on its no tipping policy, which is interesting because it's something that another restaurant has also done, backtracking on its no tipping policy, and that, of course, restaurant is Fedora.
Okay, so this is interesting. So Chang's got a mini empire, and Gabe opened up. He was one of the early partners with the Little Owl and Market Table with Mike Price and Joey Campanero. And somehow it fizzled out between the three of them. Business, I have no idea, who cares. But he kind of went under the bus for a little while. But instead of whimpering and going home back to wherever that was, he just came back full force, throttle forward, opening up restaurant after restaurant after restaurant. That Fedora space was, they approached him because that had been in a family for years, and they were looking for a young gun who they felt could sort of carry the mantle. And I really like the place. So talk about this, because this is interesting. Danny Meyer was the first one to say, hey, this is how I'm going to do all. I'm going to start at MoMA, and one by one, I'm going to roll my restaurants all into no-tipping restaurants. I think a bunch of us kind of see it as sort of the future, as kind of inevitable. I mean, Drew's a guy who I have huge respect for, Drew Nieperant. And Drew, as soon as this thing broke that Danny was doing it, the first person everyone called was Drew. And Drew's like, nah, I ain't doing that. This is America. We tip, pal. It's part of our DNA. This isn't Europe. This is America. But what's your take on this, where we are? Because you're out as more than I am, actually.
Yeah, gosh. Tipping, obviously, is a huge debate, and as you acknowledged, Danny Meyer was the first guy to say he was going to do it at all of his restaurants, that is, eliminate tipping. Right. And it's easier said than done, because when you eliminate tipping, you have to raise prices. You can get around that in other cities like San Francisco by doing a service charge. Service charge isn't really legal in New York. And so if you want to end tipping, you have to go what the Europeans call service complet, or as we say in America, service included. Thomas Keller did it back in 2000, I believe in 4 or 5, at his Per Se, one of America's most expensive restaurants. But listen, when you go to Per Se, you know you're going to be spending a little bit more. There's really not like a, it's not like you look at the Per Se menu and you see the price there, and then you look at the, you know, whatever else, the Danielle menu, and you see it's a little bit lower, but, you know, you're going to Danielle because you're going to Danielle, and you're going to Per Se because you're going to Per Se. They're exclusive experiences. But when you get more at the casual end, say when you go from one pizza place to another, price is going to play a little bit more of a role because you're probably a more middle-of-the-road consumer. You're a little bit more price conscious. And also there's more direct comparisons because even though Per Se is an entirely different restaurant than Danielle, is the pizza at, say, Roberta's that different from Speedy Romeo? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But when you're looking at both menus and one is significantly higher than the other, or at least it perceived to be, the price looks like it's significantly higher because there is no more tipping, then that might affect your judgment as a consumer in terms of where to go. And Gabe Stolman, ran into this at his casual restaurant, Fedora. And so he tried to follow in the coattails of Daniel Meyer and tipping at one of his more casual restaurants, Fedora. And it didn't quite work. The consumers, you know, when they went into the restaurant and they started ordering a little bit less. In addition to ordering less, they didn't adjust their wine buying habits. So, for example, say you went into a restaurant or you went into Fedora and there was a $70 wine. They'll still buy the $70 wine under the new menu, which is another way of saying Gabe Stillman was earning probably about 20% less on his top line. And that's important because he needs to be able to guarantee his waiters the same rate they were earning before. And that's another problem with tipping, because one of the cool things about ending tipping is it allows you to pay your cooks more because you can redistribute things that used to have went to tips. But you also have to guarantee the income of waitstaff because you don't want them to defect and go to another restaurant. So in order to do that, you have to raise prices even more than 20% because you're paying the cooks more and you're guaranteeing the income of waiters. And that can be tough to do. And that can be scary when you're walking into a neighborhood restaurant and an entree that used to be $28 all of a sudden is $35, when that $28 was a stretch in the first place. And even if you knew you were going to tip, and even if you knew it was going to be 20% higher, the consumer has a hard time getting past that psychological barrier, because we live in a country where our menu prices are depressed by 20% or more because of tipping. And so when all of a sudden you eliminate that, as much as you want to communicate that, the American consumer has a hard time getting past that.
Yeah, because it's new. It's a new math. It's a new paradigm. Yeah, so that's the reason. So he found it affected his business. It's interesting you mentioned the alcohol part, too, because I know that I love wine. I'm a wine guy. And if I'm out with friends that are into wine, we always typically tend to drink more than we needed to. You know, let's go into that. But do we really need that third bottle if there's four? If it's like, yeah, I really want to try that Chenin Blanc from Loire. I really want to try this obscure Italian varietal from wherever, Lazio. So, and that normally in my bill, alcohol is half my bill or a little bit more. And that's, you know, and you, so you're tipping like that would just pull the cork out, put it in my glass. Like that, in terms of servers being rewarded for that, I've always thought, you know, I can actually pull back rather than tipping 20% on the gross. We can pull back a little bit because let's face it, half the gross was wine.
Yeah, but and in the past that was more accessible. That was acceptable. More, I think, acceptable. But of course, it doesn't work out that way in reality, because that, of course, shortchanges waiters. And, right. You know, waiters are typically tipped out on the bottom line of the bill.
Period.
The key to making no tipping work for beverages, in my opinion, is to ensure that virtually any beverage program has to be like an exclusive one, even at the lower price points. So, for example, a diner is going to have a hard time tipping 20% or paying that 20% extra in a no-tipping restaurant on a bottle of wine they can find around the corner because they don't see the added value. But if you go to a restaurant, say, like Roberta's, which, of course, has tipping, and you see some natural wines that you're not going to find at Astor Place, then you realize what you're paying the markup for. And you realize you're tipping on it as well, because the sommelier or the waiter steered you towards a wine that, A, you wouldn't have found in the store, and that, B, you wouldn't have picked anyway on a list because you weren't familiar with it. And so that's where the service aspect comes in. That's where the tip aspect comes in. That's where the higher price aspect comes in. And so you need those two or three things in order to convince the consumer to pay more. And, of course, that's all the more complicated at more affordable restaurants, where sometimes you really just do want that cheap glass of wine. And so therein lies the conflict, and therein lies the complications of no tipping at casual restaurants like Fedora, which turned it back, like Nishi, David Chang's casual Italian-Korean place, and at Joe's Crab, a national chain, which totally thought they were going to go no tipping at, you know, a good number of their locations. And they rolled it back within months because the consumer wasn't ready. And also the consumer believed that they, you know, wanted control of their service experience, even though that's been proven to be a fallacy, that how much you tip has no correlation over the type of service you get, either during that meal or during subsequent meals.
Yeah, fact. So we're going to switch gears. We can talk about wine forever, but that, I don't want this to become a wine show. I get those guests in here for other reasons. A couple of years ago, I don't know how I guess I shop at Union Square, and I heard about this place, Bread's Bakery. So we have a New York-based finance guy who'd done really well in finance, private equity, made his money, traveled a lot to Israel. There was a bakery he loved in Tel Aviv, met this baker, Yuri, tried again and again to convince him, why don't we do something in New York? Why don't we do something in New York? Finally, he must have gotten his ear. Found this great space, 16th Street?
Thereabouts.
16th Street. It's one of those blocks right off the middle of Union Square, heading east on the south side. So, you know, they called me up, and I went to go look at the place, and it's big open space in the front. He's got breads. He's got savory foods. He's got all, you know, all the stuff you picture in a really good New York bakery. And like, great, like, the best babka you'll ever find. Really good breads made all day long, fresh to order. An area in the middle where you can kind of get food to go, sandwiches, snacks, these Scandinavian little things, and they're all great. And they took me in the back room, which you can actually see from the front. It's a big open square. I think it used to be a stereo store or something. And you can see the baking and the sheeting and all the preparation, and it's as good as it gets. It's one of my favorite bakeries. Talk about, like, your piece on his, we're going to call it a tuna sandwich for want of better nomenclature.
I think it's the greatest tuna sandwich in the face of the world. And I love tuna sandwiches. Tuna sandwiches don't really get their due. And it's incredible how in this age where everything is getting fancy and where high-end chefs are mining the lowbrow to make the lowbrow highbrow again so they can serve it at their sometimes overpriced restaurants, you don't see, just as you see expensive pizzas and gourmet $35 burgers at Michelin-starred restaurants like Minetta Tavern, you don't see the gourmet tuna fish sandwich, or at least not until you get to Bread's Bakery. Unfortunately for us, Bread's Bakery isn't exactly a high-end tasting menu restaurant. It's a store, and it's also a kiosk in Bryant Park, which is where I work, and that's how I got to know this little tuna fish sandwich. And I'll tell you about it briefly, and then I'll tell you why it's good. Briefly, the sandwich, focaccia, soaked with so much olive oil, you'd think it's almost like the focaccia version of a French dip sandwich, where they just like threw the whole thing in a big vat of olive oil. Really, really super oily and fruity. And they take good, I believe, Sicilian high-quality canned tuna. They mix it up with olives. They mix it up with halved eggs. So we're getting this kind of niçoise-style thing going on here. They add a big spread of harissa, the Tunisian spice paste or chili paste, and they call the sandwich the Tunisian, I believe. And they also throw in, for a little bit of a secret ingredient, confit lemon, which is not doesn't give it a whole lot of acidity. It's more of the rind, and it gives it that beautiful, lemony, aromatic flavor. It's the reason your pledge smells good, even though they don't use real, of course, lemon confit in pledge, which you shouldn't inhale or, of course, eat either. But listen, so that's what's on the sandwich. And the question is, why is it good? A, because the ingredients are awesome. They're all high quality. But I think there's a separate reason that signifies why all of Bread's sandwiches, most likely, are better than other sandwiches in the city. And that reason is temperature. So you walk out, you go to like Pret a Manger, or go to any other place, go to Maison Kaiser. I like to say it with the French accent. So you go one of those places and you pick up one of the prepared sandwiches.
They're
ice cold. It kills the flavor. It happened to me at Witchcraft, too, when it used to be in Bryant Park. I got a tuna fish sandwich there, and it tastes like it came out of the freezer. Just as you don't want a white wine to taste like it came out of the freezer, you don't want your food to taste like that as well. But there's a reason that restaurants and chefs do that. It's because of something called the Department of Health and the big bad guys. And so they have this pretty strict rule. And the rule is food that's prepared foods need to be kept at a certain temperature. Those foods are not kept at that temperature, Department of Health guy comes around, he's probably going to knock you down a letter grade, and then, to add insult to injury, he's going to throw those sandwiches out, or he's going to ask you to do that. So that's a double economic cost to your business. First, because you're throwing the sandwiches out, and B, because he's tacking you down a letter grade. But there's a caveat to that Department of Health rule, and it was one that was issued, I believe, a few years ago, and not a lot of restaurants know about it. You can avoid the temperature rule if you timestamp every single individual good you have. So say you're working at Barbulu, and say you have a terrine and you want to serve it. If you timestamp that terrine and say this was made at XX o'clock, and I'm going to discard it by, say, 4 hours later, I think it's 4 or 5 hours, I can let it come up to room temperature. The key is you have to throw it at the end. You have to throw it all out at the end of the night if you don't use it.
Right, or sell it, right.
And so, or sell it. And luckily for Bread's, they sell a lot of their product, and they can move it pretty well, and so it's not going to be a terrible financial hardship if they have to throw out one or two at the end of the night. But that's what makes a good sandwich, and I know it sounds like a technical rule, but, you know, all the New York City restaurants out there that are serving cold sandwiches and cold charcuterie, and
believe it or not, you can go to a heck of a lot of restaurants and your Iberico ham is going to be ice cold. Your jamon serrano is going to be ice cold. This is all because of the Department of Health. But if you go and read the regulations and you read about the timestamp rule, it's going to let you serve it in a more judicious fashion that tastes like it. That it will let you serve it at room temperature if you follow the timestamp rule. Bread's Bakery serves tuna fish sandwiches using that timestamp rule at room temperature, and that's why it tastes so damn good.
And get their babka and try the ruglach. It's insane. Their stuff's amazing.
At Eater, we kind of, one of us usually goes to Bread's Bakery kiosk about once a week, and we bring back a Friday babka, and it gets demolished in about like 4 minutes.
Yeah, it's a work of art. I've seen it made in the back. It's just brilliant. Everything there is great. I mean, I'm about to have, hats off to Yuri, because he still has the place in Tel Aviv. He goes back and forth, but he's trained his staff. They're spot on, and he's also got, if you're looking for healthy stuff, he's got like a 7 or 8 grain bread, a loaf there that's just killer. Keep it in the refrigerator, it lasts for weeks, a little bit of honey, it's as good a breakfast as you're going to get. It's just basically solid grains packed. It's like bird feed that's delicious or something.
Forget about it.
Yeah, love that guy. All right, let's, Pasquale Jones. So Ryan Hardy's the chef at Charlie Bird. I heard about the place because, long story, who cares how I heard about the place. Went there on someone's advice, knew some of the people in the kitchen, heard the sommelier is a complete baller. This guy's great.
Grant Reynolds,
brilliant guy. We'll talk more about him at some other point, but he won sommelier of the World Championship of Sommelier, which is huge. They only have it every 3 years. It took place in Argentina this year. The best of the best went there. He snagged it. So just kudos to this guy. And he still came back, rather than being like the brand ambassador for Krug or just taking like some payout and being that. He said, no, I want to work on the floor. I want to stay with the team. I want to do this.
And he's on the floor every night.
And Charlie Bird's a funny place because it's on this location. Those of us that know New York, there's like locations you're like, oh, there's no way this is going to work. So 6th Avenue, as it winds out of downtown north of Canal Street, is basically a highway. It's a feeder tube out of the Holland Tunnel. It's a feeder tube north. It's 4 lanes of traffic going into Houston Street, and they're located on the southwest corner of Houston and 6th Avenue, which is really like a non-pedestrian corner.
Correct.
You don't want to cross the street there. You'll die. Even with the light in your favor, it's like, I'm not sure I want to do this. And then the space is narrow. It's like in one place, it's like 12 feet wide. It's on 2 levels. It's the craziest non-working space I've ever seen that somebody turned into a little gold mine. They did so well there that they opened up a second space called Pasquale Jones. Talk to me about it, about the concept, about what you found out. Because I've been eating a lot of pizza lately. We're at Roberta's. I want to eat pizza today. We're in like a pizza moment in New York where it just keeps getting better. Talk about what, to your takeaway, what they had in mind when they did this and why it worked so well. And if you want to just start with the stemware.
It's Pasquale Jones is a wine-friendly pizzeria. That sounds like a bromide, but it's not. Because you will drink better wine here probably than any other pizza than any other pizza restaurant in the city, if not the country. And that's because, due in large part to their wine program and their stemware. Their stemware is Zalto. I believe Robert Bohr is a brand representative, which probably lets them get it for a slightly cheaper price than other people do. Let me tell you about a Zalto stem. It weighs about, oh gosh, pick up your iPhone. Now pick up a Zalto stem. A Zalto stem weighs just a little bit over half the weight of an iPhone. And you're already dropping your iPhone 8 times a day because it weighs so light. The lip of the stem rests against your own lip with, you know, the weight of a doily. I think I wrote in my review that drinking out of a Zalto stem is like drinking out of taking a crayon and drawing on a piece of construction paper, and then filling that with a picture of a cumulus cloud, and then imagine drinking that and like you're a pretend kid and playing house. That's what drinking out of a Zalto stem is. It's so light, it doesn't feel like it's in your hand. And that's important because when you drink bad wine, a bad wine drinking experience comes from a heavy, clunky stem. And that's because when you drink, say, a good wine out of a clunky stem, you subconsciously think more about the stem than the wine. And we can all agree we want to be thinking about the wine. We want to think about its infinite nuances and not just the shape of this clunky monstrosity, maybe even a laser-cut piece of baccarat that's too heavy. That's no good. But when you have a Zalto, you almost don't even notice the glass is there, and the wine simply almost magically lifts itself up from your table and pours itself into your mouth like you were, I don't know, like doing a bar shot at McFadden's, but in a very, very classy, Zalto-friendly way. These glasses cost $60 each. And so imagine you have 100 seats in your restaurant. Imagine multiplying 100 seats times $60. All of a sudden, you closer to $10,000 because you got to buy extra wine glasses for the ones that are going to break. And so that's why you only usually see them at some of America's most expensive restaurants. Pasquale Jones is not one of America's most expensive restaurants. It's a pretty affordable pizzeria where pizzas are in the 20s. And guess what? It's a no-tipping restaurant, and it's working. So whereas no-tipping didn't work at Fedora, didn't work at Nishi, it's working at Pasquale Jones, a pizza restaurant, an affordable restaurant. And to me, it's proof that you can make that system work in a casual, middle-of-the-road place. And they maintain that, you know, no one's, you know, getting ripped off, that everyone's doing well there under that new system. And so that's the first two things that are good about Pasquale Jones, the stemware, the no tipping. And the third, of course, is the wine list. And what's crazy about the wine list is that of their 75 or so seasonal bottles, you can order almost any of them by the half bottle, which is pretty incredible, which means they're lowering the entry-level price to trying wines you wouldn't normally otherwise try. Natural wines, weird wines, orange skin-tacked wines. And, you know, the question I ask you is, if you're a wine novice and you want to get into cool wines, do you want to go to that fancy French restaurant where you're going to be, you know, ripped off, where you're going to be eating foams and all sorts of fancy stuff, and you pay that super markup on wine? Or do you want to go to another restaurant where you can try that cool, weird wine with pizza? You want to go to that restaurant where you try the cool, weird wine with pizza. And that's why Pasquale Jones is so damn important.
Tell me about the clam pie, because the clam pie is funny. I mean, you actually kind of, not throw down, but I mean, you mentioned Franny's, which is like super famous. I remember I had Franny's clam pie when they first opened. We filmed there like literally the year they were open, and I wasn't crazy about it. You know,
neither am I, quite frankly.
Whatever, but it's for some reason, it's become this gold standard in New York for clam pies, though I'm not on board that train.
I'm not on board with that train either, and Pasquale Jones is the axiomatic argument against the Franny's clam pie. This one, quite simply, is better. It's like any clam pie. It's clams. It's pizza. They use some clam pies are heavy on cheese. I don't believe this one is. It has a good deal of cream, which is nice because it makes the clam pie evoke a delicious New England clam chowder. Clams aren't overcooked, and in case things start to get too rich, there's little wisps of broccoli rabe here and there that have been charred under the heat of the Stefano Ferrara ovens to give the pie just a little bit of a counterpoint to the creamy richness. You get a little bit of a bitterness, a little bit of an iodine flavor from the broccoli rabe. You throw some chili oil in there, and there's your meal, man. Really, really good.
And so I'm sure there's people listening around in the city and around the country that are kind of rolling their eyes at the thought of like a $22 pizza. A, the tip's in there, so
correct.
You could roll back 15 or 20% and do that math, so it's 18. But back to, like, we've had this discussion about, like, the dollar per pleasure ratio in life. There's something, I mean, that pizza for a sensible person, that pizza and a salad could qualify dinner. That's plenty of food.
Without a doubt.
You've got six slices or eight, depending on how they cut it. But there's something just ephemeral like a great pizza is a huge success. It's like something remarkable coming out of a kitchen.
Pizza is gourmet food. I believe Matthew Palombino once told me, and he's the chef at Motorino.
Right.
He used to be the chef at a fancy pants place called Cafe Boulou. And he once told me, I believe he was there, he once told me that of all the places he's worked and with all the goods with which he's worked, none has been more complicated to work with than pizza. The dough is a living, breathing thing. And just as sushi is incredibly complicated to do and incredibly complicated to source, pizza is just as complicated. And when you have a product that's so universal and so beloved, you're going to have an incredibly intelligent class of diners who are going to be able to identify the differences from, say, the neo-Neapolitan style of Roberta's, where you have a stiffer crust, to the more soupy, true Neapolitan style of Don Antonio, where you're going to have that soupy, droopy, floopy crust in the middle. And so when you have such an educated clientele and you have so many restaurants, you have to be the absolute best at what you do, and they do a pretty damn good job. at Pasquale Jones and serving it at a fair price.
And even fuel sources. I mean, New York's famous for its coal oven pieces, like the old guys, because back in the day, coal was a fuel. We still have a few of those around. Non-purist, I guess you can go with a gas-fired oven and try and pull it off. But a lot of the pieces you were just talking about are wood-fired pieces.
And they're wood-fired pieces.
It's one fuel only. There's wood in that oven. That's what it is. That's what Motorino started with. The kid that started out with the original Motorino spot that was on 12th Street, who went to San Francisco, that skinny kid from Long Beach Island.
Anthony Mangieri, I believe
Anthony
his name.
Jerry was like the pizzas. He was insane, and again with his dough, it was like a 3-day fermentation. And he was famous for, like, if he ran out Saturday night at 7 o'clock, he closed Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. I think he was only open for it as a week. When he ran out Saturday night, he was like, "I'm done. It takes 3 days to make this shit. I'll see it Wednesday."
It's a complicated process. They're expensive to make in the sense that the ovens cost like sometimes upwards of anywhere from, I think, $15,000 to $30,000 for these, you know, Stefano Ferrari ovens. And it's, you know, it's really beautiful that, you know, when you think of the apotheosis of sushi, the ultimate sushi, you're going to go to places like Masa or that Jiro place in Tokyo where you're going to spend, you know, $500 per person, $600 per person, $800 per person. But when you think of the apotheosis, the epitome, the apex of what pizza can be, you're never really going to spend more than $24. And yet the craft is still improving. It's still getting better. And that it really is part of our global gastronomic scene that everyone can participate in. And to see it evolve and get better and to be able to realize that we have a restaurant in New York where you can have some of the best pizzas with some of the best stemware, with some of the best wines in a comfortable setting and not a stripped down, no backs on your bar stool setting. And you can... And that can still be affordable. I mean, if that's not a ringing endorsement for the future of New York and saying that, you know, high-end food is accessible to everyone, then I don't know what is.
True that. What did you think of Wilder? You liked it?
I effing love it, man.
Okay, because that's another place we were talking about when you were riffing earlier about Pasquale Jones and wine. Love Wild Air. So we have the team from Contra, which opened about a year later on the same street, about, you know, two doors down or one door down. Contra's a tasting menu only. Started at $55. Now it's probably closer to $70. But it's worth every penny of it.
Correct.
Like, but it's great. They always had a dope wine list. They decided to do a more casual spot rather than a sort of... you know, bastardizing Contra by becoming a la carte plus prefix. And they open up Wild Air. It's one word named after a racehorse. A couple of words down, and it's great. Zev is basically put together the wine list, all natural wines, lots of orange wines, lots of no SO2 wines. By the glass program, it's great. You can do little bites of food. You can do a whole steak. It's one of my favorite places to open in the last couple of years.
I think it's a lot of people's favorite places. I think everyone loves Wild Air. I think... Those guys, they're so young. I think one is barely over 30. Yeah, the other is not quite 30. Contra is $67 a person. You can get in and out of Wild Air for, you know, like $50 or $60 per person. There's this one great dish there. They just put it on the menu. Raw clams, I believe, with almond milk and XO sauce. And so, you know, the almond milk kind of tames the brininess of the clams, and the XO sauce with its funkiness amplifies it. It's an absolutely beautiful fucking dish.
And that's brilliant. I mean, who would have thought that's just crazy? When you think about that, like Fabian and those guys, like who came up with that idea of like Julian? And they live near Chinatown, so they're probably getting those big ass clams from Chinatown. I don't know what they're doing, but I mean, and then XO is a Chinese, so there's like 30 different things that go into an XO sauce, and then almond milk, like what?
Yeah, for real. Or their beef tartare, which I believe has smoked shaved cheddar, a little bit of, I think, pimiento oil, perhaps just a touch of horseradish, and it's just a beautiful dish because so many beef tartares in the city right now are so classic. You know, the French style with maybe a touch of mustard, touch of Worcestershire.
Yeah. Capers, shallots, blah, 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 blah.
This one is a little off the beaten track. And these guys, what's so important about what they do is they are pushing the envelope at a price level that is accessible to so many more people than a higher-end restaurant. They're doing the stripped-down gourmet thing. They're serving some of New York's most important and edgy dishes at a price level that lots of people can afford rather than a price level that only few people can afford. And again, it's a restaurant like Wild Air that makes me optimistic about the future of New York, that even as rents get higher... And even as young artists and young chefs are pushed to the fringes and pushed further out away from the city center, artists and chefs and people will always find a unique and innovative way to thrive and to practice their craft the way they want to practice it at the fringes. And I think artists have always been the most fun and the most expressive and the most exciting when they exist at the fringes, even though I wish our city center was a little bit more accommodating to them.
The fringe keeps expanding.
It certainly does. And it's
anyway,
only
Ryan
bigger.
Sutton, always a pleasure. We'll get you back next fall. God be willing, we're all around next fall.
Inshallah.
Inshallah, as they say. I've always loved that line because it's the truth. Be well, take care. I won't see you before the summer, I doubt. Great to have you on.
Live long and prosper, baby.
Again, Pasquale Jones, Wild Air, to the place we were shouting out for. You can always read his work in Eater. Just log on any day. They have all the historical stuff he's written. He's a great writer, great voice in the city. We'll see you next week. Where I think I've got wine guests. I don't know, but stay tuned. We'll be back.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.